Accession number 19629, Reel 3.
Sir Carol Mather, Reel 3. What was there for the soldiers to do when they were off duty?
Well, there was... we were quite near Ismailia, and quite near Suez. They could walk out there, and they had Dignan's retunner. They walk out there, and then there were some nafis and things of that sort. So, there was, you know, enough for them to do when there was any spare time.
But they don't get...
And there were quite a lot of nice French girls there for the canal company. And so that was all right. Mm.
How were you recruited for the GHQ liaison squadron? Was it done
I
by
didn't
person?
Know when the commando disbanded, there was the option of returning to the United Kingdom. We came back to one's regiment. I had no intention of doing that, being stuck back in England again. I hadn't got a regiment out there, so it was quite a problem knowing what to do for the best. And the first option was David Stirling, who had this idea. David Stirling I knew very well because we lived cheek by jowl in our little troop. And at that stage, we hadn't much confidence that he could actually get anything off the ground. And he wasn't a very fit man at that stage either.
What was the matter with him?
What?
What was the matter with him?
I don't know. I think it was probably, now we call it migraine or something like that. but he was in a fairly low state. Of course, he perked up immediately when he had this plan. He became a different person. But we were all, us officers from the commando, were so jaundiced with these schemes, which never came off, that we rather shied away from the idea. In fact, I don't think he took on any officers from our commando, except one, Jock Lewis, who was a Welsh Guardsman, who was the really the brains behind the whole thing, and the one who did all the training, inventing the Lewis bomb.
What was the Lewis bomb?
Well, it was invented by Jock Lewis, and it was a plastic explosive, which was quite new in those days. It was better than gun cotton because you could mould it. A detonator, obviously. What was the other thing, that round thing you put in, the explosive? Primer.
A primer.
Mm-hmm. So you stuff the primer into the into the plastic explosive. You had a detonator, amp, which was combined with a time pencil. And so this would give you half an hour, 2 hours or 3 hours delay, according to what time pencil you had, and you squeeze the time pencil to activate it, acid and a wire inside, and the acid ate the wire away within a given time. This was actually invented by Jock Lewis. And then they did these, the best they could, training for parachute drops. Because the idea was to approach the target by parachute, by simply jumping out of the back of a 1,500 weight truck going along, and of course several got badly damaged.
Seems a rather dangerous way of training for parachuting.
Very dangerous, yes. Mm-hmm. And then the parachute, when the parachutes came, I don't think they probably weren't properly packed or anything, used again and again. And so it was fairly hazardous, that. but there was terrific enthusiasm in the unit, which was very small, only about 100 strong, or less. But unfortunately, the first operation proved to be a disaster, dropping behind the lines near an airfield, and there was a great storm, and they had blown miles off course, and I think more than half were lost, actually. And then they were going to be picked up by the Long Range Desert Group, and then the Long Range Desert Group agreed to transport these raiding parties to near their targets within walking distance and wait until the operation be carried out and then take them away again. And that's how it developed.
It is a much more reliable way of delivery, isn't it, to go in by vehicle?
Absolutely, yes. Mm. Yeah. Well, I had I had the option of joining David Sterling, but I turned it down. And then there was one of our people was going off to China, and I had the option of going off there.
What would you have been doing in China?
God knows. Yeah, what would you be doing?
Would you perhaps have been with Chiang Kai-shek?
It would have been, yes, would be with Chiang Kai-shek, yeah. Eventually my troop commander, Major Dermot Daly, who has since become commanding officer of the commando, said, "But I've been given command of this Phantom Squadron. It's called GHQ Liaison Squadron. Why don't you come and join me?" Which I did.
So it was a personal recruitment?
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
You were saying that once you joined, you had to learn about living and driving in the desert.
Yeah.
What were the particular necessary skills you had to acquire for living in the desert and for driving in the desert?
You had to have some means of cooking, which was, we had, at that stage, we had these petrol cans. We didn't have jerry cans. They were kind of fairly thin, oblong-shaped petrol cans, and we used to cut them in half, push some holes in the side, fill them with sand, pour petrol on that, and that was our cooking pot. And the upper part of the can we used as a Dixie. And this was really a kind of count throughout the Desert Army then. The driving of vehicles in desert conditions was very skilled, particularly we've got to patch of soft sand, and how to avoid patches of soft sand, how to manage the vehicle when you've got into a patch of soft sand. It was never to turn the wheels round because that would dig you in deeper. And the use of aids to get you out of a bog condition, which were sand mats, rolls of canvas with wooden slats in, which we kept on the front mudguards, and sand channels, which were steel channels, which we put underneath the wheels. But you had to do a lot of digging to get through the sand, to get onto a level. Navigation, another very important point, with direct reckoning, a prismatic compass on a bearing. A lot of driving we did at night, so you were taking bearings on stars, and you had to know how the heavens were moving, and when you had to take a new bearing on a different star. And the sun compass, which was invented by Bagnold, who formed the Long Range Desert Group, which was really a mobile sundial with various settings and everything. We had a card called Azimuth Card, and when the sun was out in the daytime, this was fine. If you use those, they were pretty accurate. So those kinds of skills, camouflaging up the vehicles. Obviously, we had fitters with us each. We were formed into patrols of three vehicles each, and each patrol had a fitter and a wireless operator and drivers. So you had to, the question of repair and maintenance of vehicles is very, very important.
How would you go about camouflaging your vehicles?
And, of course, cipher, the wireless sets and the codes we had to use. High-grade cipher.
How would you go about camouflaging your vehicles?
Yeah, we camouflage nets.
Nets. And you mentioned maintenance and repair of the vehicles. Were there any particular components that were most likely to break down in desert conditions?
Well, of course, spare wheels. We had to have spare tires, spare wheels. That was a frequent cause of a breakdown. of course, we went over rocky ground. It was quite easy to crack the sump. But those were major repairs. Of course, you had to have it taken out to repair that sort. Our 1500 weights were quite sturdy. Of course, they were not four-wheel drive, but they were quite tough and quite sturdy. And we weren't really going through much soft sand in the northern desert. We didn't have tents, and we just slept out.
What sort of clothing did you normally wear?
Well, this was when I first joined. It was just before the winter campaign of 1941, which was, can't remember what the operation was called. now, this was to recapture Tobruk, really.
That'd be Crusader?
Crusader, yeah. The summer campaign, which was a fiasco, was called...
Battle Axe?
Battle Axe, yeah, yeah. This was Crusader. And, well, there were two objects. One was to recapture Tobruk, and the other was to destroy the enemy armor. And this was really what the fighting consisted of up to the time of Alamein. And this was destruction of the enemy armor. So they were highly mobile warfare. It was more like naval warfare, because you were searching out where the enemy armor was. But they were doing likewise, of course.
The main problem in that is actually finding them, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you were in the desert, what sort of clothing did you wear to be comfortable?
Well, in the winter, we wore battle dress. Just ordinary battle dress. In the summer, we wore shorts and KD shirts.
Now, you mentioned... later on, after 6 months in the desert, you had desert sores.
Yeah.
Yeah. what could you do to look after your health in living in the desert?
I don't think we had any vitamin pills. I think we used to have salt pills for hot weather. But there was nothing you could do, really. It just happened to be, it was the diet, I suppose, and the... Particularly the backs of your hands became extraordinarily brittle. Even putting your hand in your pocket and catching on the thing. And so a lot of people had bandages wrapped around their hands. It was really a vitamin deficiency, I think.
Were there any other hazards to health living in the desert?
it was a pretty healthy existence otherwise. I mean, the rations were adequate, really. Obviously, much the same. Obviously, we never had any fruit or anything like that. We were living entirely on... Compo hadn't been invented then. We were living on canned, you know, either McConaughey or tinned fruit or whatever. I don't think there was any... particular advice we were given about keeping one's health. I mean, everyone looked after himself, really.
Now, you mentioned that in the autumn, November 1941, you took part in a deception. You were sent off to simulate the signals of
armoured this was
division.
My first action with the GHQ liaison squadron. And I was told to go off of my patrol to the oasis of Jeroboam, which was beyond the further south than the battle line at the time, and slightly forward, and simulate the signal traffic of an armored division. And this came out of my head. So what the German intercept thought of this, I don't know.
How did you go about doing that? Did you make it up as you went along?
Yes, made it up as I went along, yeah.
Did you ever meet a man called Strangeways, Colonel Strangeways?
What was he engaged on?
Well, he was eventually head of deception for Montgomery.
Right.
He ran our force in Northwest Europe.
I expect I did meet him, but I can't recall it.
But not at that time.
The deception, by that time, had become very professional indeed and was very successful prior to the Battle of Alamein.
But on this occasion...
He was still in the amateur area at this stage.
Yeah. How much traffic could you generate, you know, with your...
We were using Morse code entirely.
Right, yeah.
And I mean, I had my chaps on it the whole time. They're short messages.
And presumably you were sending in cipher, or were you using clear as well?
We were. Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point, actually. I think we were probably sending it in clear then.
You were mentioning earlier on the use of ciphers. What sort of high grade cipher did you employ? Your own signals.
Well, it was a high-grade cipher, and we had a cipher book, which never changed. and I now can't remember how it actually worked. I mean, I did the ciphering and deciphering, but we hadn't by that stage got the the kind of frontline cipher book with those slides and things.
Slidex,
yes, that's right. We hadn't got that. So it was called high grade cipher, and it wasn't too difficult to use. We used we had a number 11 set and a Windom aerial, what was called a Windom aerial.
What was that like?
Two pearls, about the size of a kind of Babington net. Two pearls and a wire going across.
What sort of range could you get out of that system?
Yeah, we got pretty good range, really. They must have got up to we were working back to Army headquarters, 8th Army headquarters, and we were up with and I was up most time with an armed brigade. So there were distances about certainly 200 miles.
Did you find the set reliable?
Very reliable. They were wonderful sets. Yeah.
What was the best time of day?
Entirely in Morse code. Entirely in Morse code.
On the key?
Yeah, on the key. Yeah.
What was the best time of day for communication?
I don't think we were aware, actually, of any particular... We always communicate in the evening, really. Apart from this particular exercise we were doing down at Jeroboam, our messages went across in the evening.
How long were you at Jeroboam doing this deception?
A week. Or five days for a week. It was quite eerie down there, because there was nothing. There was nothing to be seen, no one about.
No native population?
No. The OSS had been fought over and rather smashed up. We were actually rather forward. There weren't any palm trees in that gap where we were. We were slightly forward of the OSS itself.
Did you ever discover whether or not the Germans had actually bought the plan?
No. Oh, no, I'm sure they hadn't. But it was just some signal traffic taking place at the bottom of the line in order to draw the Germans' attention to that area and think something funny might be happening down there.
It's creating a diversion.
Yeah.
You're mentioning that in November, 4th Armoured Brigade headquarters was overrun and dispersed.
Yes.
Mm. Were you there with them when that happened?
I was. Mm. This was the City of Rezeg, Battle of City of Rezeg. Mm. Yeah. And this was all about the occupation of the airfield, so-called airfield. I mean, there was no sign, when you were there, there was no sign of an airfield. It was really a landing strip. Mm. It was flat desert with no features, no buildings, nothing. but it was slightly higher ground. It slightly overlooked Tobruk. And that was the strategic interest of it. And at that stage, we were... the garrison was going to break out with I tanks, and we were going to break in to join them. And it was 7th Armored Division. We had three armed brigades. I was with the 4th Light. Well, no, it wasn't called Light then, it was 4th Armored Brigade. And Brigadier Alec Gatehouse. it was a very confused, extremely confused day. One really had no idea what was happening at all. But John Campbell played a very prominent part on the beginning of the day by leading the tanks up into the attack in his staff car. A big tank battle had taken place that day, and the 4th Armored Brigade was involved, not quite so heavily as some of the others. And towards the evening, that was the battle of City of Rezeg. Towards the evening, we were sitting on the City of Rezeg position. We were suddenly overrun by Germans, arrived from an unexpected quarter of the tanks. But this was our armor screen had been broken into, and there we were, surrounded by tanks. So we all scarpered as we might.
You just drove
every man for himself. Well, the armored brigade headquarters was two tanks and one ACV, which was a new armored command vehicle, was a new thing. That was the group. And I had my three vehicles some distance away. Of course, we all had to disperse very widely in those days because of our attack. And so it was every man for himself.
Did your three vehicles keep together in the scarp?
No, the two disappeared.
You just burst off.
I was left with one vehicle, which happened to be the wildest truck, was lucky. And we had a little group was joined up, and there was one 25-pounder gun, one honey tank, and my one vehicle, and the Brigadier CRA, Command of the Royal Artillery, 7th Armored Division.
With one gun.
Huh?
With one gun.
With one gun, one 25-pounder. We didn't know where we were going, or we were really looking for friendly faces. and there were massive little groups, similar, spawning all about the desert, all lost. And saving the Germans too, actually. And the Germans, sometimes they picked up British three-tonners with drivers, but the British three-tonners just followed a little group, you see, and they didn't attempt to do anything to them.
you're all intermingled with each other.
Yeah.
were you able to use your wireless to get in touch and to find out what was going on during this chaotic period?
Well, we did use our wireless that evening, but we were communicating with 8th Army headquarters, and we didn't really know where we were, what the situation was, apart from the fact that we'd been overrun.
And How long did it take to get things back together again, to reconstitute?
We spent a whole day just driving around the desert, occasionally bumping into German groups of this kind, but which we didn't engage, and they didn't engage us. and towards the, I think the next day, we found the brigade headquarters again, which then consisted of one tank. The brigadier, fortunately, when this was happening, was out meeting the 7th Armored Division commander, so he wasn't actually at the headquarters when it was overrun.
He wasn't caught.
No, wasn't caught. No.
You mentioned that you were sent off on a visit to the Levant, which was in an unstable condition after...
A visit to where?
The Levant, to Syria and Palestine. Yes.
Well, we pulled out of the line in March 1942. And we were sent up to Palestine and Syria for really political intelligence.
Was this something you'd done before, political intelligence work? Had you done that kind of work before?
No. and I had two jobs at the time. One was investigating this tribal battle that was going on between two tribes, the Ruela tribe and the Haitat tribe.
What was that about?
Land... grazing, yeah, that kind of thing. And I stayed first with one side and then with the other, and I was treated very with great hospitality. And I left my vehicle behind. I rode with them on a camelback, and vehicles joined me later on. And so that was something rather amusing to do. And then the other main job was... up on the Turkish frontier in Syria, doing road reports of the tracks and roads leading into Turkey, because at that stage we hoped the Turks were going to join us, or maybe they weren't going to join us, and they might have been persuaded by the Germans to move into Syria, and so they wanted to know what the tracks were like. Unfortunately, the frontier wasn't marked. And so we strayed well inside Turkey and ended up at a police post and were surrounded. And we couldn't fight back. And we were detained for about 12 hours until they'd reported the fact to higher authority. And eventually the message came through, we would be released.
Do you know... Have you any idea of how far you got into Turkish territory?
About 2 miles, I think. there were no marks on the Syrian side. And the first was this Turkish police post, which we came to. But one of our men, fortunately, with great presence of mind, had asked me if he'd go behind a bush. I think they hadn't really consciousness then, and he made away, and he ran back to our lines and gave the alarm.
What were the roads and tracks like in that area? Were they good for the movement of large
dirt
bodies?
Tracks, gravel tracks, very little tarmac. And we were using very ancient maps, which were French maps, which were probably copies of the pre-First World War.
Were there any signs of development or improvement of the communications network in that area?
None at all. No.
Did you get any impression of the capacity of the road system leading into Syria?
We were reporting on the roads and the width of the road and any bridges or culverts. I mean, you could have it was unlikely that two vehicles could have passed coming towards each other without one getting off on the side.
A single track. yeah. systems.
Mostly single track, yeah. Mm.
Did you do this all the way along the frontier, or just on
We did it in the from the coast for about a length of about 25-30 miles.
Mm. Was there any activity?